Good morning, everyone. I wanted to start out first with a reminder that we do have our final exam next week. There are no other classes next week, so we do not meet on Tuesday at all. You already had your last day of lab, so the only thing that left is the final exam. It's a week from today on Thursday. It's going to be in this same room, the regular lecture hall, but it starts at a different time than the normal lecture time, at 9:15 a.m. So if you are in Section 2 and you normally come a little bit later, just a heads up that, again, the final exam is at an earlier time than the normal lecture time. The first thing that we're going to do today is to go over the answers to exam number 3. I almost finished the grading of the exam, but I didn't want to rush it before class. But I am going to be available after class for any of you that wanted to stay back and wait while I complete the grading. Or if you didn't want to wait, I am going to have them available in office hours tomorrow morning if you're able to make it to office hours. I will be announcing some form of office hours for next week. I don't know which days and which times yet, but I'll be sending an email out to the whole class. Or the other option is that once I do finish the grading, I can scan them and email them to you, which if you'd rather do that, you can just send me an email and then I will send you back the exam if you didn't want to wait or you weren't able to show up to any of the office hours times. So in case any of you are listening to the recording, if you weren't here in lecture today, the same goes for you. If you would like to email me to let me know that you would want me to scan your exam and send it, then I can do that. But I am going to go over each of the questions now and go over the answers so I can at least have that to be able to study for the final. I will say that the final is comprehensive. In other words, it is going to cover everything that we did do this quarter, including up through this last exam. And we will do the review of the final topics after we go through the answers. So that's what we've got lined up for today. Whether there's going to be any lecture today that I do or not depends on whether or not I'm left with any time. But it is extremely unlikely that anything that I did cover today would be on the final. So everything that had occurred up through last week is going to be the material for the final. So shifting over to the third exam, the first question was a redo of the redox question that was on the previous quiz. So let me write out the chemical equation. We had nitrogen monoxide, NO, reacting with oxygen, as well as sodium carbonate, which formed sodium nitrite, along with carbon dioxide. So the first part of the question is that you had to come up with the oxidation states for each of the atoms in this reaction. So remember, there were a handful of rules that we used to determine oxidation states. One of the main ones is that oxygen, being one of the most electronegative atoms, almost always has a negative 2 oxidation state. And in fact, none of the examples that I'm going to give on the final or any of the examples we've covered in class, none of them have had the exception where if you have a peroxide, then oxygen has an oxidation state of negative 1. So in nitrogen monoxide, oxygen would have its normal negative 2 oxidation state, which would mean that nitrogen would have to have a plus 2 oxidation state since this is a neutral substance. Now for oxygen, the gas, that's an unreacted element. And any elements in their normal states end up having a 0 oxidation state. Then in the substance sodium carbonate, we have oxygen that again is going to have its normal negative 2 oxidation state. And hopefully you recognize this as an ionic compound because carbonate is one of our polyatomic ions. Sodium, in this case, would be an ion on its own. So given that sodium's in the first column of the periodic table, it'll have a plus one oxidation state. So if we have two plus ones, because there's two sodiums in the substance, and three negative twos from the oxygen, that all adds up to negative four. So that means that the carbon has to be plus four in order to balance it out. Now, if we look at the products, we have nitrite, which again is one of our polyatomic ions. So that means sodium is going to be its normal plus one, oxygen is negative two, and so that means that the nitrogen in this case is going to be plus three. Then the last substance, carbon dioxide, each oxygen is negative two, which means carbon in this case is plus four. So then if we look at what's changed between the reactants and products, we can see that nitrogen went from a plus two to a plus three oxidation state. So that means that nitrogen was oxidized. So that means nitrogen monoxide was the reducing agent. Because whatever has lost electrons, you could turn that around and say it gave electrons. So whatever is oxidized was the thing that was doing the reducing. Then if we look at oxygen, the oxygen in carbonate is already negative two, and so are the oxygens in the product. But then we have the elemental oxygen that had started out as a zero oxidation state. So you could point to any of the oxygens in the product because we're not sure which one that oxygen ended up in. But we could see that oxygen went from zero to negative two. So that means that oxygen was reduced, which is almost always what it's going to do. Oxygen is always an oxidizer unless you have some kind of reaction with fluorine. So oxygen was reduced, so oxygen elemental was the oxidizing agent. Which it wasn't part of this question, but previously it had been asked, what is an example of a common oxidizing agent? And out of all the ones that you should know that oxygen is an oxidizing agent. Now, as I go through these, if you have any questions, stop me, because I'm worried about how much time I have, so I'm just going to keep right on going. The next question was about constitutional versus stereoisomers, and you were asked to explain the difference between the two. So constitutional isomers have the same molecular formula, but different structures. The way I might have said it in lecture is different bond connectivity. Different atoms hooked up to different atoms. You are asked to draw an example of a pair of constitutional isomers and stereoisomers as part of your definitions. So I saw several different types of examples. One was in different forms of butane, so that's a four-carbon compound. You can have a linear butane, or you can have what's known as isobutane, where you have branching in the middle instead. Some of you gave an example that I might have done in class as well, of a six-carbon compound. In one case, you have a double bond, so that's C6H12. But another way to come up with the same formula is to have a cyclic compound that doesn't have any double bonds. So that example shows that you can have a difference in functional groups. Another example that I saw was in two different forms of an alcohol. Or not two different forms of alcohol, but two different oxygen-containing functional groups. So one had a carbon-carbon double bond and then single-bonded oxygen, but another version had a double bonded oxygen and a single bonded carbon-carbon bond. So all of those are perfectly valid examples because they all have the same molecular formula. As far as stereoisomers, they have the same bond connectivity. The same atoms are hooked up to the same atoms. But they have a different three-dimensional arrangement. The easiest example is to see double bonds in their trans versus cis configurations. So that was one common example. Another example that some of you did was to show different forms of dash and wedge. So, for example, someone must have remembered seeing limonene in lecture, because although this is not the structure of limonene, this demonstrates exactly the type of relationship that you'd have between stereoisomers. Now, if you showed anything like this where you change from a dash to a wedge, or, for example, some of you did this type of thing. You had carbon with four different substituents on it, and you showed the same type of mirror images that I showed in class. If you did anything that even resembled either of these types of examples, I gave you credit. Now, it turns out this middle case here, this specific example, those are in fact the same molecule, which if you built models, you would be able to tell that. But that's something that's beyond the level of this course. So even if you had the idea to change a dash and a wedge to show some difference in 3D structure, even if in a more advanced analysis it turns out those molecules are the same, I totally ignored that because that wasn't something I expected you to be able to recognize. So just knowing that there's this difference in 3D structure, that was good enough. The next question was where you had to convert between a line structure to go to a fully condensed structure, and then, or not fully condensed, fully expanded structure, and then you had a fully expanded structure that you had to go to a line structure with. So give me a moment to copy the expanded problem into the notes here. I was surprised how well as a class you all did on these two parts of the question. There were some minor mistakes that I saw, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So the part that confused people the most was dealing with the triple bond. And so if I wanted to make the line structure by just following the carbon framework, we've got three carbons on the left there, and one of those carbons connects to a triple bond. So notice there is a single bond line that goes towards the triple bond, because in the original structure, there is a single bond that exists between two different carbons. So on the other side of the triple bond, you need a single line as well to show that single bond. And then we have a couple more carbons left. So there's the outline of the molecule. Now, you do leave the hydrogens out that are connected to carbons, but I might not have emphasized enough that you also leave the bond lines out. Because if, for example, you drew the bond lines in and just left the hydrogens out, then what that means is that there are carbons there. Because anytime you have something where the atomic label is missing, you assume that it's carbon. So you have to leave the hydrogens and the bonds connected to the hydrogens out. So on the left-hand side, the only thing else we would write in is the nitrogen along with its hydrogens. The rules for line structure don't make simplifications for nitrogen, so you do have to show those hydrogens. But you notice how I've condensed the way I've written it to leave the bond lines out. And that's because that's very commonly done in order to show the functional group. and many of you did exactly the same thing, which is perfectly acceptable. On the right-hand side here, there is an OH group, and there is a chlorine. So another small mistake that was made is some of you put the chlorine right here at the end of the double bond, but the chlorine does need its own single bond connection to show the single bond that really exists. So most people either got this one right or with just some of the small errors that I mentioned. Now, going the other direction, from the line structure to expanded, same thing. There were some common small problems that I saw, but overall as a class, you all did fairly well on this question. So let's do the same thing where we expand out the carbon network first. So looking at the zigzag line, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 carbons that are in a row. And then attached to this third carbon, 1, 2, 3 over, there's a triple bond. So again, there does need to be a single line connection going to that triple bond to mirror the single bond that's in the line structure. Now we'll draw in the things that aren't carbons. So we have the sulfur with its one hydrogen. We've got the nitrogen with its two hydrogens. And then we have this double bonded oxygen. Now I left out the double bond here between these two carbons. So now the only thing left to do is to fill in the hydrogens. So on the left, there's only one bond shown, so we need three hydrogens there. The next position over, we're going to need one hydrogen along with the next one as well. Moving along the zigzag, the next carbon's already got four bonds drawn to it, so we don't need anything more there. The next two each have three bonds, so they each need one hydrogen. And then down at the very bottom, the triple bond, the top carbon already has four bonds, so there's nothing else that goes there, but the bottom one needs a hydrogen. So any questions on these first three problems? Okay, moving on to the next one. You were supposed to identify the functional groups in these molecules. So let me draw those out and then answer what the functional groups are. Okay, so the first functional group is actually one that was on the previous quiz, which is an alcohol. The next one is, I think, one of the first functional groups I might have introduced. That's the carboxylic acid. If you said acid, I ended up thinking that was good enough, and so I accepted that. The next one is an amine, although if you said amino, I accepted that as well. The next one, so the one mistake that happened to a few people is you looked at this structure and said, okay, there's a ketone here and then there's an ether there. But when you have this oxygen connected to the carbon-oxygen double bond, that changes how both of them behave. So this is no longer two different functional groups. This is one functional group, which is an ester. Same thing with the next molecule. If you looked at that, you might say, okay, there's something that looks like a ketone and then an amine. But when they're connected to each other like that, again, it changes the way they behave. And so that is actually an amide. Now, if you said peptide, I accepted that because a bond between two different amino acids is known as a peptide bond. More appropriately, the functional group is called an amide. But since if you said peptide, you had the right idea. So then I accepted that answer. Question five. Water is an unusual substance due to the fact that solid ice floats on liquid water, which is backwards from most substances. So you're asked to explain why does the ice float and explain why this happens. So the reason why it happens, and you didn't have to draw a picture like this, but some people do better seeing the picture. So it turns out that water forms these hexagonal patterns when the temperature reduces, water moves more slowly, and the attractions between water can take over. So at low temperature, the hydrogen bonds in water are able to pull water molecules apart. Creating spaces and therefore increasing the volume, which decreases the density. Now, before I say anything else, the hydrogen bonds are there even if you have liquid water. But when you have liquid water, it's liquid because there's enough energy that now the molecules can slip past each other. So the hydrogen bonds don't bring water more closely together in the liquid form. It's just that they're not pulled apart in the liquid form. They have enough energy to slip past each other. So hydrogen bonding is an effect that has more importance in ice, where the temperature drops and those hydrogen bonds can take over. And then once you say that the density increases, then you would say that ice floats because it is less dense than water. Next question was also about water. It was about specific heat. So you're first asked to define the term specific heat. So specific heat is the amount of energy needed to raise 1 gram of a substance one degree Celsius or Kelvin in temperature. The part that some people forgot is that it's for 1 gram of a substance. So there is another concept, which is heat capacity, which is the amount of energy it takes to raise an object in temperature by 1 degree Celsius or Kelvin. But specific heat is for 1 gram of that substance. Then you were given some information about example where you're asked to calculate how much energy would be needed to raise 275 grams of water from 25 degrees Celsius to 80 degrees Celsius, and you were given the specific heat of water. So remember, there's an equation that goes along with that, that the energy needed is equal to that specific heat times the mass times the change in temperature. So the specific heat was 4.18. And I left out the units because if you really were observant, you could use the units to figure out what the definition of specific heat is. So 4.18. Turns out the units are joules per gram Kelvin or Celsius. The mass was 275 grams, and the difference in temperature You end at 80 degrees and start at 25 degrees, so you simply subtract 25 from 80. So I've forgotten the number. Let me multiply that out and find it out again. So you didn't have to use significant figures, but if we were going to round, then we've got two sig figs, so you could round it and say 63,000 joules. It was 63,222.5 if you didn't round it off. And I did not look at sig figs for that question at all. The next question was the one question on the exam that seemed to give people more difficulty. So you had this reaction of hydrogen gas and oxygen gas forming liquid water, a combustion reaction. So first you were asked, does breaking a bond, is that an endothermic or an exothermic process? And there was a lot of confusion about that. So breaking a bond requires energy. When you form a bond, energy is released, because that's why bonds form, because systems end up at lower energy by making bonds. So to undo a bond requires energy. So it is an endothermic process. Then you were given information about the bond energies for hydrogen, 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 oxygen, and oxygen, oxygen. So what might have helped is if you drew a picture of what was going on. Because you had three different bonds that were breaking. There were two molecules of hydrogen and then one molecule of oxygen where those bonds were breaking. And then the part that got most people is that there are four oxygen-hydrogen bonds forming. Each molecule has two, but you had two molecules of water. So how could you figure out the energy change that was happening? Well, you needed two times the hydrogen-hydrogen bond breaking plus the energy for the oxygen-oxygen double bond breaking. And then you subtract out four times the oxygen-hydrogen bond. Because again, hydrogen-hydrogen is a bond that's breaking, which is a positive number. Oxygen-hydrogen, because it's forming, that's a negative number. And that goes along with the fact that endothermic processes have a positive energy change because you're getting energy, and forming a bond is a negative energy change because you're releasing energy. So if you plug the numbers in, you get 2 times 435, that number was given to you, plus 502 minus 4 times 464, which, let me do that calculation really quickly. So when you add that all up, it ends up being negative 484 kilojoules, kilojoules per mole, which is exothermic overall. Which makes sense, because if you've ever seen hydrogen burn in oxygen, you know that's quite the exothermic reaction. So continuing on, you had a question that was related to catalysts, and you had this empty reaction coordinate diagram that you had to label. So you had to label the axes, which in this, the y-axis is energy. The x-axis, I accepted a couple different things. If you said time, you had the right idea, but the better thing to put would be reaction coordinate. Then the other things you were supposed to label are the reactants, which are over on the left, the products, which are on the right, the transition state, which is the top of the diagram. That's that highest energy point between reactants and products. And then you have the activation energy, which is the amount of energy that it takes to get from the reactants up to the transition state. So that was the first part of the question. The next part of the question asks you to define activation energy, and then using an appropriate diagram, explain why larger activation energy causes a reaction to go at a slower rate. So the activation energy is the energy needed to reach the transition state to start a reaction. And then the best explanation for why a higher activation energy means a slower reaction is to use the energy distribution diagram that you had seen. And that diagram has this kind of shape. And the axes here are the energy per molecule on the x-axis, and then the number of molecules on the y-axis. The best way to do the diagram would be to have two different activation energy shown on the diagram. And the reason for that is that if there is a higher activation energy, fewer molecules have that energy. So the reaction proceeds more slowly. Then the last part of that question was explain why a catalyst causes the rate of reaction to increase. A catalyst provides an alternate reaction pathway that has a lower activation energy. Which, since that means there are more molecules that would have that energy, that's why the reaction goes more quickly. So just a few questions left, and they were more bio-related, most of these. You had asked to define the term carbohydrate. And that's a substance with the general formula CH2O multiplied by X, because that's what the term means, carbohydrate, carbon with water. And then you're asked to explain the difference between a monosaccharide and a disaccharide. So a monosaccharide contains only one sugar unit. More correctly, if you wanted an expanded definition, is that if you react a sugar with water, you only get one individual molecule back out. But a disaccharide contains two sugar units. and again expressed a little bit more in detail, is if you react that sugar with water, it will split apart into two different units. The next question was to describe the difference between an aldose and a ketose, which you were had to identify a couple of molecules as being aldoses or ketoses. So let me just use those molecules to explain the terms. So this first molecule happens to be galactose, which is part of lactose or milk sugar. This other molecule is fructose, which is fruit sugar. So the difference between these is this first one is an aldose because it contains an aldehyde. Whereas this other molecule is a ketose because it contains a ketone. So next question, you had to draw a triglyceride that is formed from an unsaturated fatty acid. So remember, a triglyceride is a molecule that comes from glycerol, which a molecule that the glycerol by itself has three alcohols on it. In a triglyceride, that is converted into an ester. And one way that you might have simplified writing out that structure, because some of you were copying what I had done myself, is to use this R notation to represent a long carbon chain. Now, unsaturated means that you have a carbon-carbon double bond. So either in your notes or even in the structure itself, you somehow needed to show a carbon-carbon double bond in the acid part of the molecule. The question did ask what functional groups are present, which I didn't really look at that, but if you did have the unsaturation, you technically have alkenes present. But what the question was really getting at is what is a triglyceride, and it's an ester. So that's the main functional group I was looking for. If you said alkene, you are technically correct, but it was the ester that I was more concerned about. So the last question was to draw the generalized structure of an amino acid. So the generalized structure we had seen in class was something like this, where you had the amino group, the acid, and then an R group if we're talking about the amino acids that are the ones that make up proteins. The next part of that question was to identify the functional group that links one amino acid to another in a protein. So an amide links amino acids together in proteins. And then the last part of the question was to explain what the sequence of a protein is. So the sequence of a protein is the order of amino acids in that protein. So were there any questions over anything from the exam? Then even though it's a little bit early, why don't we go ahead and take our break, because this is a logical time to do it, and then we'll come back and do the final exam review. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to walk through the textbook and I'm going to go section by section, because we do have the topics the way that I reviewed them in the notes during the quarter, but to just help out and be more specific, I thought I'd look at each section, identify the topics that we did cover, because I know there are some sections in each of the chapters that we ended up not covering. So rather than to refer you back to the notes, I thought we'd make a fresh list of all the topics. So returning all the way back to chapter 1, there were some of the initial concepts in chapter 1 that ended up skipping. So some of the general concepts of what science is in general and about scientific laws, we didn't cover those because we jumped straight into chemistry. So, in fact, we didn't pick up until section 1.5. So that's where we would start. And all of these topics I'm going to list in order that they are in the text, and that they're not necessarily the order that I presented them in lecture. So some of the earliest concepts were what is mass versus weight. Mass is a certain amount of matter, whereas weight is a force that you experience because of gravity. We had the difference between physical properties and chemical properties. Or more appropriately, physical and chemical changes. So physical change would be something like melting, freezing, boiling, one of the phase changes that doesn't involve a change in the substance itself. A chemical change would be anything that causes a change in a substance, like if you were to burn something or if some other form of chemical reaction was to occur. Section 1.6, we started to pick up a lot of terminology. So we had, for example, the terms element, substance, mixture, and compound. So remember that elements are types of atoms that differ by the number of protons that are in that atom. A substance is anything that has a consistent molecular formula. A mixture is a combination of two or more substances. And then a compound is a substance that has two or more different types of elements that are part of its formula. In section 1.7, we had the metric system. So that included the various metric units, some of which you didn't end up having to learn. So, for example, we never did talk about electric current or intensity of light, but you had to know things like the meter, the kilogram, the second, Kelvin, and mole. Liter is a measure of volume, and the only reason it's not listed in this list in the section here is that you can come up with volume by using length as well. So I might have mentioned at some point that a milliliter is a cubic centimeter. So I'm just explaining why the liters were left off the list. But if we're talking about volume, it is more common to use the liter, so that's why I'm including it in here as well. We had the metric prefixes, which you didn't have to know all the ones that were in the book here, but there were a few that I had asked you to know, including giga, which is capital G, mega, which is capital M, kilo, which is lowercase k, centi, which is lowercase c, milli, which is lowercase m, micro, which is a Greek lowercase mu, and then nano, which is a lowercase n. So in that same chapter, we had square and cubic units. Square centimeters, for example, could be used to talk about area. cubic centimeters could be used to talk about volume, and that this was our first opportunity to talk about unit conversions, which later on, one of the most important unit conversions was going from grams to moles, but we'll come back to that later on in this list. Section 1.8, you had density. And then section 1.9, you had temperature scales and your units of energy. So I'm not going to ask you to convert between different temperature scales. So from this section, you really just need to know what Kelvin is. And then the units of energy, I know that comes later on in the chapter, or later on in the text, so I'll list those later. We didn't cover section 1.10, so that's it for chapter 1. Now, as I'm going through this list of topics, since this is our last chance to discuss, if you had any questions about any of the concepts or items that I'm listing, now's a good time to do it. So moving on, we'll go to chapter 2. Which was about atoms. So there is the fact that the word itself, atom, comes from a Greek word, but that's not something I'm going to quiz you over. And so we'll just skip to section 2.2, where we had several fundamental laws of chemistry. One of these is the law of conservation of mass. Which says that in a chemical reaction, you can't create or destroy mass, but you can change its form. We have the law of definite proportion, which says that no matter where you find a particular substance, it's always going to have the same ratio of different elements. And then we have the law of multiple proportion, which is actually in the next section. And that says that you can have different elements that make different substances by having different ratios of those same elements. Now, also in section 2.3, we had Dalton's atomic theory. Moving on to section 2.4, that's where we first got the concept of the mole and molar mass. In that section was therefore also our introduction to the AMU. So I remember one common source of confusion is there's the term atomic mass and then the term atomic mass unit. So the atomic mass unit is a unit of measurement, a tiny measurement. But atomic mass would be the physical mass of some type of atom. And so you could use AMUs to measure atomic mass, but you could also use grams. It would be a small number, but you could use grams to come up with atomic mass. Section 2.5 was a bit of history behind the periodic table, which we didn't end up really covering. And then section 2.6 was our first introduction to the concept of what a molecule is. So as a commentary, remember that we contrasted a substance like water versus a substance like sodium chloride. Water is a molecule because those atoms are all directly connected to each other. In something like sodium chloride, you just have all these positively charged sodiums and negatively charged chlorines that are all attracted to each other, but no specific bonds between any two atoms. So that was something that came up when I was asking about the terms compound and substance as well. Because both water and sodium chloride are compounds. They are substances, meaning they have the same chemical formula throughout. They're substances that contain more than one element. But for water, it's a molecule, again, because the atoms are directly connected, where in sodium chloride, the atoms are not directly connected. So that's not necessarily all in section 2.6, but that was our class discussion that we had. That was the end of chapter 2. So any questions about the topics in that chapter? Okay, then moving on to chapter 3. Chapter 3 got more into atomic structure. So there's certain parts of section 3.1 that we ended up covering. So some of these terms you got later on in the textbook, but the ones that are important here are what an ion is, what a cation is, and what an anion is. We never did come back to talk about some of these historical experiments, which they're interesting. If you didn't read them, then now having gone through the whole quarter, it might be easier to understand this section. But we didn't talk about the specific experiments in this section, so we'll skip over those. Same thing with section 3.2. We never did really get into that. Or in section 3.3 about nuclear radiation. We did talk about the Rutherford gold foil experiment. Because it was an experiment that did give the idea that there is a nucleus to an atom. And that leads up to the next section, which gets into the structure of an atom. The fact that it contains a protons, neutrons, and electrons. And the idea, again, that there is such a thing as a nucleus of the atom. So the nucleus has protons and neutrons. The electrons swirl around that. Then we also have some new terminology. There's atomic number and mass number. So an atomic number is how many protons are in the atom, which identifies which kind of element it is. And then the mass number is the combination of protons and neutrons. And where that matters is in isotopes. Isotopes are the same element, so they're the same type of atom, but they have different numbers of neutrons, which means they have different mass numbers. So an isotope has the same atomic number, but different mass numbers. In class, I might have talked about specific isotopes that you needed to know. For the final, it's fine that you don't know them. But we just to mention it, we did talk about hydrogen having three different forms. Protium, which is where there are no neutrons. Deuterium, which has one neutron. And then tritium, which has two neutrons. Now, section 3.6 is where things got complicated. So there's the Bohr model of the atom, which, to do it in picture form, the Bohr model was something like this, that you imagine that there's a nucleus at the center of the atom, and that there are electrons that are circling in fixed orbits around that atom. And the way that we have evidence that that structure, or what the evidence that led to that idea of atomic structure, is that atoms only absorb or release specific frequencies of light. And so when an electron absorbs light, that electron's able to move further from the nucleus. When it moves back closer to the nucleus, it releases light again. So the fact that there are only specific frequencies of light involved means there's only certain positions around the nucleus that the electron can exist in. And so that's what the Bohr model of the atom was related to. Of course, this is also the origin of the quantum concept of what an atom is, which is what we got into in section 3.7. So in 3.7, we got orbitals, shells, and subshells. So an orbital is a region in space where an electron can exist. When you combine all of the same type of orbital, because there are S orbitals, P orbitals, D orbitals, different types of orbitals, when you combine all of the same kind of orbital, that's a subshell that's within an overall energy level. And so I remember doing a diagram something like this, where I talked about the energy level, which would be the shell. We had the subshell, which would, for example, be like an S orbital. And then I probably drew these lines to represent the individual orbitals inside of a subshell. It's in the same section that we got electron configurations. Which that fed right into section 3.8, because electron configurations are really what demonstrate the periodic nature of the periodic table. So in section 3.8, we got the terms group and period. So a period is a particular row on the periodic table. A group is a column on the periodic table. And what makes groups behave similarly to each other, or the elements within a group behave similarly, is they all have the same valence electron configuration. So remember, one of the central types of problems that we covered at this time was to look at, for example, the halogens, fluorine, chlorine, and bromine, and to talk about why do they all behave the same way. And it's because if you look at their electron configurations, they all have the same number of valence electrons, which that's what we used later on to be able to figure out what charge those elements would form. So that was a very important section, 3.8. Now, at the time, you had to memorize different family names, different group names. I'm not going to ask you to memorize those names for the final, but you need to know that concept, what I referred to earlier, that all the elements in a column, all the elements in a group, behave similarly because of the number of valence electrons that they have. Which, that all made more sense once we got into the next chapter, because the next chapter gets to the octet rule, which helps explain why things behave similarly. So let's move on, in fact, to chapter 4. So in chapter 4, we started with section 4.2, which were Lewis dot structures. That first section only dealt with dot structures for individual atoms, but it set us up for the octet rule, which is mentioned very soon in the chapter here. Now, this chapter got us to our first discussion of different types of bonding. So ionic bonds are mentioned in section 4.3. And then 4.4 is where we finally got the octet rule. And that's when we were able to start talking about ion charges. Because elements on the left-hand side of the periodic table are closer to getting an octet by losing electrons, which is why they tend to be cations. Elements on the right-hand side of the periodic table are closer to being octets by gaining electrons, and so they tend to be anions. Then once we get to section 4.5, that's where we started having naming. So names of ionic compounds. Then in section 4.6, we finally got to what a covalent bond is. And that's where we first learned about lone pairs and then single, double, and triple bonds. Now, of course, there's something that determines whether or not you're going to form an ionic or covalent bond, and that's this concept of electronegativity. Which, if you look back in the notes, I think I remember introducing electronegativity a lot earlier than this point because it explains so many things like the way that water behaves. But in terms of order in the textbook, that's what shows up in section 4.7. Now, we never did do the names of covalent compounds. I think I had discussed about them in lecture, but never put them on a quiz or exam. And so at this late point, I don't want to go back and make you have to relearn how to do that. So naming of covalent compounds, I'm not listing it because it won't be something that you have to do. So section 4.9 is where we got our polyatomic ions. So things like sulfate, nitrate, chromate, cyanide, hydroxide, all the same ions that you had to know before, you still have to know for the final. Which, after I make this list of topics, I'll talk about strategies or recommendations for studying for the final. One of those will be to go back and look at your previous quizzes and exams. So section 4.10, that's where we had Lewis dot structures. Now I'll go ahead and say that because it was something we only did in lab, that for the lecture final, therefore, you don't have to know how to do formal charge. I really like structures that show formal charge, but you're not going to be required to be able to draw it. You'll just have to be able to draw the structures themselves. And this was a huge chapter because right after the Lewis dot structures, we got Vesper theory, which is where we got our shapes of molecules. And the same five shapes that you had to know before: linear, trigonal planar, tetrahedral, trigonal pyramidal, and bent. Those same structures, those same shapes, are the same shapes you still need to know. And remember that we talked about molecular polarity. The fact that some shapes are symmetric, which means that whatever polarity that you have in individual bonds can cancel out. And some shapes like bent are never balanced out, and so they are always polar. So more specifically, I'd say you need to know molecular polarity versus bond polarity. Because again, you can have bonds that are polar, but if they balance out, then you end up with a molecule that overall is nonpolar. This is a huge chapter. So any questions from the topics of this chapter? Okay, let's keep moving on. So moving on to chapter 5. So in chapter 5, that's when we first got to chemical equations. So one of the first things that we did was to balance chemical equations. I guarantee that whatever problems you have on the final will be the same difficulty level as what you had on the quizzes or exams. So they'll be relatively straightforward as the questions were on the quizzes or exams. Nothing that's going to be really difficult to balance. We didn't ever really discuss section 5.2, but 5.3 is where, again, the concept of moles came back in. And also, percent composition. Determining, for example, the percent of hydrogen in some kind of substance. Now, that led to section 5.4, where we got stoichiometry. And that's where we had problems like the following. Suppose I have a chemical reaction and I tell you how much reagent that you have. How can you use that to figure out how much product would be produced? And remember, those types of problems had three conversions in them. Because normally the problem started out with mass, but one of our big topics of discussion was the fact you can't do these problems in terms of mass. You have to do them in terms of moles, because atoms react by how many atoms there are, not how big or how massive they are. And a mole is a number. So first you had to go from mass to moles. Then you had the chemical reaction that showed you the relationship between substances. So then there was a conversion from moles to moles. And then the types of questions I ask for an answer in grams. So then you had one more conversion factor to go from moles back into grams. And if you go back and review our notes, we had a few examples I worked that had exactly that three-step sequence of conversions. Now, also in Chapter 5 were solutions. So we had our sol words, like solute, solvent. And then the word solution itself. In that same chapter, we had molarity, which, remember, is abbreviated capital M as far as a unit, and it's also represented by these brackets if you want to show that you're talking about a concentration. Molarity, in fact, is a general form of concentration. Which there were a few other units of concentration we talked about. We talked about mass percent, volume percent, and parts per million. So you still need to know those same forms of concentration. That was it for Chapter 5. So let's move on to Chapter 6. Chapter 6 was about phases of matter. So in section 6.1, we talked about solids, liquids, and gases. And remember, we talked about them from two different perspectives, what they look like down on the atomic level or the microscopic level, and then what they look like at the human scale or what I call the macroscopic level. So we talked about how solids and liquids are both what are known as condensed phases. And then we talked about whether the different phases had the same, whether they hold their same shape or not, whether they keep the same volume or not. And then we also had all of the different phase changes. So melting and freezing, which are going from a solid to a liquid and back again. We had evaporation and condensation, which are going back and forth between liquids and gases. And then we had sublimation and deposition, which are going back and forth between solids and gases. We next talked about 6.3, which dealt with different types of intermolecular forces. or IMF for short. So we talked about dipole-dipole attractions and what a dipole is. We talked about what different forms of dispersion forces are. And then there's also another form of dipole-dipole attraction, which is hydrogen bonding. Then section 6.4 dealt with forces in solutions. So there's a difference between what happens when ionic substance goes into solution versus when covalent substances go in. So the ionic case is the one we talked more about. That's where ions have to overcome their attractions with each other and then be surrounded by water molecules in a process known as hydration. And if you get more energy back by the ions being hydrated than the amount of energy it took to pull them apart, that's the biggest indicator of whether that process is going to be favorable or not. For covalent substances, it's whether the solute prefers to stick with itself, or the solvent prefers to stick with itself, or whether it's more favorable for the solute and solvent to interact with each other. This same chapter dealt with gases, so we have 6.5, which deals with kinetic molecular theory. Which is actually where that energy distribution diagram comes from. It's not shown in this section, but that is the origin of where it comes from. It's also where you get your definitions of what an ideal gas is. And it says there are 5 different concepts, but we focused on 3 of them. The fact that gas molecules effectively occupy no volume, that they don't have intermolecular forces, and that they don't lose any energy if they do end up colliding, either with each other or with containers. So section 6.6 dealt with the behavior of gases. So as a reminder, the way we discussed them in class was about talking about a balloon versus a metal can and what would happen in different situations, like if we change the temperature, if we change the pressure. So what all that led up to was the ideal gas law. PV equals nRT. You don't have to memorize R. That would be given to you. And actually 6.7 more directly deals with the ideal gas law, along with the alternate version, which is P1V1 over T1 equals P2V2 over T2. Where would you use one equation versus the other? Well, if you had, for example, the temperature, the pressure, and the volume of a gas, and you needed to calculate moles. Well, moles are not present in this other version of the equation, so you need the normal ideal gas law. But let's say that you fill the balloon up in a room at a certain temperature and pressure, and you change the conditions. Well, assuming that no gas leaks in or out of the balloon, you don't need the number of moles, but you need to know how the conditions are related to each other. And so then that's when we would use this second form of the equation. Any questions from that chapter? Okay, we are making progress. It's an awful lot that we've covered over already, but we're getting there. So moving on to chapter 7. So this is where we got acids and bases. So 7.1, the only thing it really talks about is what an indicator is, a substance that changes color depending on its acid-base environment. In section 2, we got our Arrhenius and Bronsted-Lowry definitions of acids and bases. So remember that Arrhenius' definition is founded on water, that an acid is something that produces H+, that a base is something that produces OH-. The Bronsted-Lowry definition instead focuses just on H+, that an acid provides H+, a base accepts an H+. So we had the term neutralized, which is where you have equal moles of an acid and a base reacting with each other, which is not the same thing as the term neutral, which we'll get to in just a moment. So section 7.3 we didn't really cover. So moving on to section 4, you need to know what strong and weak acids and bases are. That strong acids extensively dissociate, meaning undergo bond breaking to release their H+. Weak acids don't like breaking apart to making H+. So now skipping to 7.6, that's where we got the pH scale along with our definition of neutral. Remember, a good definition of neutral is not a specific pH value because pH changes with temperature. So a better way to define neutral is to say it's when you have equal concentrations of H+ and OH-. We really skimmed over the rest of the chapter, so this is really it for chapter 7. Any questions from it? All right. Then chapter 8. Chapter 8 was on oxidation and reduction. So 8.1, that's where we got the definitions of oxidation and reduction. And I'm going to put a commentary here, which is the focus on electrons. Because yes, sometimes oxidation is when you gain oxygen. Sometimes reduction is when you gain hydrogen. But not all reactions involve oxygen or hydrogen. So the better definitions to stick with are what happened to electrons. So in oxidation, something loses electrons. Reduction, something gains electrons. You still need to know some common oxidizers and reducers. And just like the test problem we just reviewed, you do need to be able to come up with oxidation states, because that's the only way you can tell if something's being oxidized or reduced. So in fact, section 8.2 gets into oxidizing agents or oxidizers and reducing agents. Remember, some of the easiest ones to remember, you can think of the periodic table. Oxygen being so electronegative, it loves to steal electrons, so oxygen is an oxidizing agent. Something like hydrogen gas or sodium, things on the left-hand side of the periodic table, they tend to be reducers because they love to react by giving away electrons. Now, section 8.3 is where we got electrochemical cells. So you might remember the picture we drew of two different containers containing different electrodes. One of them, the anode, the other, the cathode. And you had to explain where was oxidation occurring, where was reduction occurring, which way did the electrons flow, and what was this thing, the salt bridge, which is a substance that's used to balance out charges that are formed during the reaction of electrochemical cell. We did not end up talking about different types of batteries, so we skipped the entire rest of this chapter. So this is it for chapter 8. Question, yes?
Just a quick question. So for the electrode, anode, cathode, and salt bridge, we're just going to name it? Like, we're going to get a drawing of naming it, or?
So very similar to the question that was on a quiz or an exam, yes. That if I describe the way that a cell behaves, that you'd be able to draw a picture of it, identify where the anode and the cathode are, identify where, how electrons are flowing. So very similar to the type of problem that you worked before. Okay, so that leads us to chapter 9. Which was on organic molecules. So section 9.1, lots of terminology. I'm going to put in here that it's outside of the textbook, but I still want you to know about line structures, because they're just so much more efficient at representing organic molecules. Terminology that was in the text, you had what hydrocarbons are, and then our list of, I'll just say, functional groups, which some of those extend into the next sections as well. But in the first section, we had alkanes, alkenes, and alkynes. And I'll just say you need to know what all the different functional groups are. So all the same ones that showed up on the quiz or exams, they're the same ones that are all in this chapter. This section also dealt with isomers, which we have our two types of isomers that you still need to know, which are constitutional and stereoisomers. So section 9.4 is our list of functional groups. Just like before, you do not need to memorize any specific molecules of any functional groups, but if I named a functional group, you'd need to be able to draw an example molecule, or like on the recent exam, if I draw an example molecule, you need to be able to name that functional group. So, although there's lots of pages in this, since you didn't have to memorize specific examples, that really takes us up all the way through section 9.7, which is the end of the chapter. So not quite so many topics in that chapter. So, moving on, one of the chapters we didn't manage to get to is polymers. So if you have any interest in reading further, I'd say out of the rest of the chapters in this text, polymers is a useful one to read because those include all different forms of plastics. So if you wanted to know a little bit more about what is the structure of different types of plastics, chapter 10 is good for that. But since we didn't cover it, certainly not going to be on the final. Nuclear chemistry, that chapter, there are some important parts of that chapter, most specifically medical applications of nuclear chemistry. So if you were interested in that aspect, then I would say it's worthwhile to look over the chapter. But again, since we didn't cover it, not going to be on the final. Question?
Is what's going to connect with something?
9.4 through 9.7, they were all just different functional groups. That's all that was covered in those sections. Both. So we skip over chapter 11, which, let's see. Chapter 12 wasn't even on the syllabus, nor chapter 13, nor chapter 14, I believe. Oh, no, chapter 14 had a little bit in it. So chapter 14 in section 14.1, that's where we got our different unique behaviors of water. So that's where we talked about the expansion of ice, meaning the fact that ice is a less dense form of water than liquid water is. The fact that water is amphoteric, that water can act as both an acid and a base. And this is where we got our introduction to specific heat, because water has an unusually high specific heat. That is the only thing in the chapter that we covered. So that is the only section in the chapter that you need to worry about. Chapter 15, that's where we talked about energy. And there's an awful lot in that chapter that we ended up talking about, but I'm going to simplify what I might ask on the final. So we talked about state functions and systems and all that, but really on a practical sense, what I'd want you to know are those terms endothermic and exothermic, and our discussion of bond energies that we had. And then in section 15.3, we went beyond the textbook to be able to talk about reaction rates and catalysts. So that's where we had our reaction coordinate diagram. That included our discussion of activation energy and transition states. So exactly what was on the recent exam. And so beyond that would be what catalysts are. That was it from chapter 15. So what we have left is just chapter 16, which is the chapter on organic molecules. Biological molecules, I should say. So chapter 16, the same types of things you needed to know for the exam are what you'll need to know for the final. So in section 16.2, we had carbohydrates, including what mono and disaccharides are, what aldoses and ketoses are. But you don't need to know the polysaccharides. You don't need to know what the difference between alpha and beta linkages are. In 16.3, we had fats, which are triglycerides, and then what fatty acids are. In section 16.4, we had proteins, which are when amino acids are linked to each other. So you should know, just like for the exam, that amino acids come together by amide linkages to form proteins. And you should know what the sequence of a protein is, which is the order that amino acids appear in a protein. Even though we discussed it, I'm not going to put any of 16.5 or 16.6 on the final. So this is the end of our list of topics. Sorry, there we go. So any last questions on any of the topics that are going to be on the final? So then my question. So the grades are going to be submitted the week after finals week. They're due in by the Wednesday of finals week. Normally, I don't email out grades only because I'm very sensitive to privacy. If someone somehow gets into your email account and you don't realize it, then that's release of grade information. So you'll just have to wait for it to be posted to the My Portal, which normally that should happen by the Thursday right after grades are submitted. I will possibly have your grades turned in earlier than that Wednesday, but I don't know whether the online system will update earlier then. So the final exam, let me think of a way that I would be able to do that in a way that would not result in release of grade information. So by the time of the final, I'll figure out some way to be able to do that. Now, for studying for the final, best thing to do is to go back over the quizzes or exams that we've had this quarter, because it's not that the questions necessarily will be identical, but a lot of them will be quite similar. For example, naming compounds, there's not any other way for me to ask how to name compounds than to ask you to name compounds. So some of the things you're going to do would be very similar or identical on the final as they were to on the past exams and quizzes. After that, I'd recommend going back to our class notes. You've got everything posted from the whole quarter on the website. After that, if you still had time, then I'd recommend going back to reading the text and or working sample problems. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of class, I will have office hours next week. I don't know the times or dates yet, but I'll be emailing out to let everybody know what those are. And I do have regular office hours still tomorrow morning at 9:30. That'll be the last day of normal office hours for the quarter.